welcome to another episode of ReScience, where my co-host Jeff and I spend some time with authors and of popular science book, and we ask them how do they go about making complex science topics engaging and compelling and understandable to the general public. And today we will be talking about oncogenes and carcinogens with authors Dan Fagan and Jessica Wapner. And I'm very pleased to introduce science journalist Dan Fagan, who has written this really engaging book called Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And I read this, or I listened to it on audio back in March. And Dan is a science journalism professor at New York University. He is a nationally prominent journalist on environmental health topics. He has been a principal member of reporting teams that were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize and has won both the best-known science journalism prizes in the United States from the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the National Association of Science Writers. He writes in Nature, the New York Times, Scientific American, Slate, New Scientist, and he's an associate professor of journalism and the directors of the master's level Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program, one of the oldest and best regarded science journalism training programs in the world. Welcome, Dan, and look forward to a nice conversation about this book that tackles environmentalism and cancer and science and epidemiology. I learned a lot from this book, by the way.
And Joanne, it is my pleasure to be introducing Jessica Wapner, who describes herself as a freelance science writer, which I think is one of the most admirable jobs in the world because I don't know how to do it. She's interested largely in health, medical, and related issues like that. And her work has appeared in all of the places that have become familiar to people who read science, like the New York Times and Scientific American and Slate and Science and other top journals and outlets. And I've just discovered, as I was looking into this, that she blogs for the Public Library of Science. Her blog is called Work in Progress and deals with issues in the world of drug development, including ethics, which is very interesting. She's written about cancer research and treatment, and that is the core of her first book, which is an amazing first book, Jessica, called The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. And I have one right back here. And I will confess that I'm only halfway through, but what a rewarding halfway it has been so far. And I'm waiting to see what happens. But I was delighted to learn. I mean, I now know these words like oncogene and what they mean. And I even, when I review it, I wrote down a phrase, and it's like I was delighted to discover that I understood all the words in this phrase, having read that.
I know how you feel.
Yeah, and that is a very nice feeling. And I want to start with the simple, really broad essay question for everyone that has been a theme we've talked with before with other people who are writing about modern topics. And as I read your book and hear about Dan's book, I realize that since I was in college and an adolescent, say, starting to read about science and learn about things, how we understand what cancer is, and I'm looking now at Dan, what causes cancer and how these things happen has changed in amazing ways that no one would have dreamed of, and that many people might not be aware of, that you're both getting the word out about. And so I'd like to start with a sort of overview from both of you. What is our current understanding? You know, what has changed about how we see what cancer is, what do we think it is today, and what do we understand now about the complicated causes of cancer? Mm-hmm. Jessica, would you care to start?
Sure. Yeah, thanks for that really nice introduction, and thanks so much, Jeff and Joanne, for the invitation to be here. Mm-hmm. It's great to be here joining Dan. So I think I'll start with I'll answer in terms of what this book, the trajectory that this book follows, which is that cancer is a genetic disease, or that's one of the sort of increasingly common understandings, right? Like, if you walk up to the average person on the street and say, what's the cause of the common cold, right? You can say it's a virus or it's a bacteria. Right. Everybody, you know, that's common knowledge. But if you walk up to the average person and say, what's cancer? It's not cancer is a genetic disease, it's cancer is a deadly disease, or cancer is something I don't want. but it's not cancer is a genetic disease. So I think one of the themes in this book, and that certainly other books have covered as well, The Emperor of All Maladies for sure, is that increasingly we are understanding cancer as a genetic disease. And there it is. And that's not to say that all is an amazing book. That's not to say that all of the underlying causes are random genetic changes, but that the root lies in our genes. I'm sure Dan has lots to add.
Sorry about that telephone, if you can hear it.
nice ring.
Yeah. So I totally agree with Jessica that one thing we can say for sure, well, as sure as you can be about anything in science, which is never completely sure, is that cancer is a disease of genes. People are confused by that because they assume that if cancer's a disease of genes, it's a disease of heredity, and that's not necessarily the case, although certainly there's a heritable component to some cancers. And that's what makes it exasperating, too, because what we can say with confidence about, there's not a lot that we can say with confidence about what how cancer begins and why it begins. But one thing that is almost certainly true with most cancers is that it requires a series of things to go wrong, right? Genetic hits. As Jessica mentioned, some of those could be completely random. Some of them might not be random. Some of them might be related to nutrition or smoking or something else that we experience in the environment, which is what I write about. So it's complicated, and then of course the big complication is that if you ask people about cancer, they assume that cancer is one disease, and it's anything but one disease. It's it's 200 plus, and you know, as we keep identifying new variants, you know, we're actually much higher than that, depending on how specific you want to get. So cancer really just describes a series of observable things that you could say about all cancers. They involve rapid cell division, out of control cell division. But besides that, they don't have that much in common. And so, of course, that makes finding a cure, you know, some sort of unitary cure or unitary cause, almost impossible.
But I've been fascinated to read and also to realize that all of this understanding, both about what a carcinogen might be and how it can actually do something, and how cancer is genetic, and how then in the world that can be related to environmental carcinogens through this rather complicated but really interesting to unravel process that involves these viruses, these oncogenes, these protein kinase things, these phosphorus things to get moved around, but the clarity is coming along, and I'm feeling like, from my understanding of what it was 30 years ago, which was pretty poor, which is like, smoking causes cancer. Well, how does it do that? Well, it does.
Right.
It's like, you know, we now have a lot more insight than we did then about how the genes are involved, how a virus is involved, what these might actually do, how the environment might come in over here to scoot along, and how it's causing that excessive cell division. What an amazing amount of stuff to happen, and it's been so active in the last 30 years. And if I were to read any of these books, which is a useful thing, you know, the idea of the cure for the cancer takes on a lot more nuance now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, it certainly does.
I just want to chime in. So I've when I was in undergraduate and graduate school as a cell biologist, primarily, the things that Jessica talks about in her book, how they discovered how chronic myeloid leukemia is related genetically, and then the role of tyrosine kinases and phosphorylation, the role of those in phosphorylation in setting off a cascade of events. These were things we were talking about actively in school because they had just recently been discovered. And I'm going to let Jessica speak more on this. I really like your book, Jessica, because I felt like it did a really great job in showing that scientific discoveries are not about one person. And boy, there's a lot of women involved in this. Always happy to see that. Because everyone, you know, there's a lot of assumptions that men are making the great discoveries. But this just showed this continual flow of, you know, this person found this, and this person found something similar, and then somehow they found each other, and then we're, you know, snowballing this information. Yeah. And your book takes place over the course of, what, 50 years, 30 years, for sure?
Yeah. I mean, it starts, well, the chromosome was discovered in 1959, this genetic mutation. And I describe work even going back to 1910, course, with the with Peyton Rouse at Rockefeller University discovering this virus that caused cancer in chickens. I'm so glad to hear that that came through and that that was one of the things that stayed with you, because that's one of the things I loved about this story. And the thing that made it seem challenging in the beginning, because there's no hero. There's, you know, later, of course, a hero kind of emerges with Brian Druker, but certainly in the first part of the book, in the basic science years, the heroes are everybody, and they're not, nobody was trying to do anything. Nobody was saying, oh, here's this genetic mutation, let's figure out how it causes CML, chronic myeloid leukemia, so we can make a drug. You know, this was not what people were doing, because nobody understood the genetic underpinnings of cancer. And nobody understood that you could make a drug to target that. Nobody understood that the genes encoded protein that triggered the signaling cascade that led to white blood cell production. So it was really just people doing science that then tied up together. And there's this one moment that I describe in the book where there's scientists, this couple who are having a glass of wine together one evening, and they're only, I think they were in the States somewhere, I'm trying to remember where they, I have to remember the exact details, but they had left their home countries because they could not do the cloning work that they wanted to do at the time where they were, because there was this sort of alarmist fear of where that research could lead to in the laboratory. So they had gone to other laboratories so that they could pursue what they wanted to pursue, and ended up kind of one night having this conversation of, you know, I think, you know, so-and-so found it was this gene that leads to chronic myeloid leukemia, and someone else saying, oh, that's funny, because I think that that gene is located on this chromosome that's involved in this genetic mutation. And, you know, and it was kind of like, oh, well, I think let's go check that out, you know. And lo and behold, that was kind of the final, you know, tying together of all of these pieces. Don't worry, that doesn't ruin the story for you.
No, not at all. And I, as I was reading it, and of course someone who's been at the bench and reads, you know, lots of research, I was just amazed at how well you captured that. I mean, you didn't capture the tedium and the boredom, but I felt like you captured that, which, you know, because you might dissuade readers. I mean, but other than that, I felt like you really captured this scientific process quite well.
Thank you.
And as I read it, of course, being a cell and molecular person myself, I went, wow, I think every, you know, somewhere in your undergraduate years, every cell and molecular biology student really ought to read this book. Because it starts to tie together things that they learn here and there, and you know, maybe only memorize just for the test, as we know students do. So,
yeah, thank you.
I think you're right too, Joanne. That what emerged that gave a very good sense, largely because you were writing in a book rather than an article, and you had some expanse of time to show this.
Yeah.
That a broad amount of solid research of people and your great imagery was though it's as though they were all made one brush stroke on a painting that became a work of art without, you know, each one of them trying to create that painting. People who are following, you know, good, clever, dedicated scientists working in a field, something can emerge from the solid work that they're doing that starts to lead to a broader understanding, and that is a lot different from the picture people conceive of maybe someone saying, well, let's create a drug that targets this, and the you know, NIH says, here's some money, but you need to be more practically oriented or something.
Yeah.
And this is the science that I recognize, too, in the world of physics, where things happen, but it looks like there's a lot of people just doing a lot of weird crap that doesn't seem, you know, well, trying to figure out why chickens, you know, senators are going to make fun of people studying why chickens get cancer instead of doing something useful.
Yeah.
And that's just so wrongheaded, and that's a really good understanding for people to have. And I have now, I'm watching Dan over here, and I want to ask him, because I've had to deal recently with someone who is convinced that in the environment there are good things like vitamins and air and stuff, and then there are bad things known as chemicals. And she insists that chemicals are bad things. And, you know, and then there's this whole thing about what's carcinogenic, what's toxic, what's bad, and, you know, like,
Stay away from that H2O. That'll get you every time.
There are chemicals over there, and they're bad. And, you know, so I'm going to beg you, give me some help on dealing with someone. You know, it's like, no, why are they bad? Why can things cause cancer? You know, that there are reasons things are bad, and not just because they're chemicals.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that question. It's true that there's a lot of so-called chemophobia out there that many of my colleagues in science journalism write very articulately about that. That, you know, the world is composed of molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, you know, their chemistry is how those particles fit together, and in that sense, chemicals. We are chemicals, so
yeah.
You know, that silly industry slogan, "Without chemicals, life itself would be impossible," is of course actually true. But of course, there's a big on the other hand, and that is that this information is often manipulated by folks who produce toxic chemicals to say that, well, it's just another molecule, and all molecules are not created equal in terms of, you know, whether they're good or bad for us. So while I strongly object to the use of the word chemical as a pejorative, I, on the other hand, I very much recognize that we have big problems in our society, and I trace how we got into this position, you know, in Toms River, starting in the early 1850s with the development of the synthetic dye industry, which then grew into the synthetic chemical industry. Mm-hmm. And there was way disproportionate attention paid to, you know, how much money we could make from producing those chemicals, and too little attention paid to the potential health risks that those particular synthetic molecules posed. So what I think you should tell your friends are that quit using chemicals as a pejorative, but recognize that the world is complex and that some molecules do wonderful things for us, but at the same time, some molecules do not. And the process of figuring out which of those molecules are harmful and in what way are they harmful and how can we, quote-unquote, prove it, is incredibly complex and difficult and also fascinating. and that's mm-hmm. the process. That's the process that I trace in Tantra.
So I'll take a minute here for our viewers to basically summarize. And what I'm going to do is use Carl Zimmer's blurb on the back to give an overview here. But as Carl Zimmer, the great biology writer, says, Tom's River is an epic tale for our chemical age. Dan Fagan has combined deep reporting with masterful storytelling to recount an extraordinary battle over cancer and pollution in a New Jersey town. Along the way, we meet chemists, businessmen, doctors, criminals, and outraged citizens. We see how Tom's River is actually a microcosm of a world that has come to depend on chemicals without quite comprehending what they might do to our health. And your book, you know, I can only think of a few modern books that do what you do, which is to look at so many facets of a topic and weave it together and pull it together and bring life to the people in the story and the sequence of events. And this goes, like you said, way back to the synthesis of chemicals. So we've got the science there. Then we also have the science of how do we know something causes cancer? And then the science of epidemiology, which is trying to figure out, well, does this cause cancer? You know, did this particular event of the pollution cause this cluster of cancers? And I was just held with rapt attention. This is one of those books where I was just like, okay, I can't put it down. So I really, really enjoyed what you did with that. So what I want to know is how, you know, as I'm not a writer at all, I will never put that descriptor next to my name. How do you say, this is interesting, was it through a series of stories you'd written for other places, or this was just something in your mind? You know, how do you say, I'm going to create this story that starts here and ends here? I know that's a hard question because I'm not a writer, so I feel like I'm not able to even ask the right question.
Yeah.
How do you go about
it? No, that's okay.
Such a great story based on truth.
Thanks. Yeah, truth makes it harder, but it also makes it more rewarding. It makes it a lot more rewarding. Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question. And it's interesting that you quoted what Carl said about the book, because Carl Zimmer has a book called Microcosm. You know, mm-hmm. Carl is the master of the very small, writing about the very small things. He loves microbiology. And, you know, he makes the point that microcosm is actually a fantastic word. Because it's micro, very small, and cosmos, the universe, everything. So it's describing something very big in a very compact way. And that's really the essence of good journalism, is that, you know, you want narrative, you want a confined story, but you want that story to stand for something very big. And I loved the story of Tom's River when I first heard about it back, it would be almost 20 years ago, because I thought it had all those elements that I thought were really essential. It's an incredibly human story. It's steeped in science, but it's science at the edge of science, which is, you know, the murky, uncertain place. And the borderlands. And the borderlands are where things get interesting in science. So I love that about it. And I first heard about Tom's River when I was a reporter for Newsday here in New York. And I had written a lot about cancer epidemiology, about spatial and temporal patterns of cancer, and what do they mean, and how can we interpret them, because that was a very big issue here in New York, especially with regarding breast cancer. There was still is a lot of breast cancer activism. Mm-hmm. So I had written a lot about that. And what was frustrating is that the quality of the science was poor on Long Island. Mm-hmm. It wasn't what it should have been. So when I heard about Tom's River and that the activists there had raised so much hell that they got the federal government and the state government to come in and do a really first-class piece of science, you know, really good epidemiology, and with a kind of a fascinating, unexpected result, I thought, wow, that could be a really good story. So I covered it at the time, and then when I went to NYU and became an academic, really just a journalist, but doing it from a university, I remembered that story and thought, you know what, this deserves mm-hmm. a book, because it could be a microcosmic book, mm-hmm. you know, a mm-hmm. book about something confined that tells a really big story and is also totally relevant to what's happening in the world today, which is why I finished the book in China.
I have maybe what's striking me is a similar sort of question, a writerly process for Jessica, too. And one of the ways that I always judge a book in this context for us is, and this is where I came up with the word scienticity, was how well integrated science is as part of the rest of the story, or does the author try to avoid, you know, scientific topics, or try to avoid saying anything that sounds scary? Well, I don't know, Jessica, how you could have told this story without using a lot of scary words. And sometimes, I mean, I have some other books in mind where I get to the end of the book and I amaze myself by reading a summary paragraph and say, I could not have understood this paragraph at the beginning of the book, but I understand it now, because one way to look at this book is that it deploys these ideas through the vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And you have to have those if you're going to talk about the subject or even think about it in any sort of productive level. Otherwise, you spend all of your time, you know, using long phrases to describe things. Mm-hmm. But being able to understand that vocabulary at the end tells us a great deal. And you've got an awful lot of vocabulary to deploy in this book. And I know that you do it purposely, so I want to talk.
Yeah.
It's working out really well, and I'm enjoying feeling like I'm getting this. And I don't know whether the readers will realize that, you know, learning a vocabulary so that they can participate somewhat and follow a modern discussion about this is a really valuable byproduct of reading fascinating stories that are, you know, dramatized, personalized accounts of these events. I'm enjoying learning all these words because they're coming along. So I don't know. Is there a question in there? It's an essay thing, but, you know, how are you deciding when you go ahead, you do the word, and, you know, without a dull, this is what this word means, this is what, using it in the midst of a story is the way to start teaching us what the word means and how it's used.
Yeah, I have stopped that. I mean, because it was a hard decision with writing the book, because the story of the creation of Gleevec has been told here and there. For example, there was a Smithsonian Magazine article about it. People who are in the field know about the story, but it had never been, the full length story had never been told. From 1959 and then going back to 1910 and really digging into the science. And I struggled with that because, you know, I was like, God, no, who's going to want to read all this? You know, I mean, it gets, you know, it was either don't do it or go for it, you know, get in there and dig in. And I really felt like if something, so there's two things. So I felt that if something is real, right, there has to be a way to explain it in a way that is engaging. Mm-hmm. If it is, you know, okay, it's science, it's technical, I just don't buy it in a way. I feel like there has to be a way. If something is the truth, if something is biology about life, it has to be, there has to be a way that everyone can understand it. Otherwise, it's not worth knowing, in my opinion. You know, because who does that help? So that's on the one hand, and I love that. I found as I was writing it, I discovered this kind of love of, you know, finding the analogy that I felt could really bring it home. It was just something I really enjoyed doing. So I kind of started to just embrace the technical aspects of it. And as much, you know, as hard as it was, you know, my poor little brain, like, okay, today is viruses, you know, we're going in there, and I would sort of come out a week later, like, I think I understand it now, you know, not quite sure. But I wanted to do it. I also, at the same time, felt that I really, really wanted to create a situation where the reader would feel rewarded. Throughout the book with these little understandings and little aha, I get it, kind of moments. And then I guess I was sort of hypothesizing that when the story gets emotional later on, that the emotion, that experience would be all the better for having come through the science, that it could kind of sort of seep down from your brain into your heart, kind of, and that it would be a deeper and more long-lasting experience to see the survival of patients. You know, when you read about these patients who were saying their goodbyes and tidying up all their loose ends because they only had a few years to live. Then taking this drug that was, you know, if anything can be described as a miracle drug, right, this would be it, that experience would be so much more breathtaking, knowing that this 30 years behind it, 40 years behind it, of, you know, extraordinary lab work, you know, that was never with anyone thinking, I'm going to save someone. You know, that's, you know, maybe some people were, but that kind of wasn't really the motive. But here you had people who were just, you know, asking questions, doing their lab work. Yes, they wanted to do something. They wanted their work to matter. But they weren't thinking about, you know, LaDonna LaPasa, who would be getting up out of her wheelchair, having chosen her burial plot, you know. So it was both that I loved the idea of just finding ways to explain something that would otherwise seem too complex, and also what that would then give readers later on.
Yeah. Well, I think we both can agree then that the excuse that, you know, is technical, it's science, therefore it's impossible for you to understand. You shouldn't trouble your you know, pretty little head about it, is just an excuse to reject. But the part that goes along with that, I've learned, is like, I believe, and this was true when I would talk about my own research, I believe most people can understand most things about science, but sometimes it takes some time. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, you've taken the time to write about that. So then that takes us over to Dan with a journalistic question. What do you do when there's not time enough to do that, and when the public understanding just isn't quite there, because you want to, at all costs, I think, you want to avoid being misleading or imprecise or wrong.
Right, right. Well, Jeff, you know, that's what we do for a living. What I do in particular, because I also teach other people, you know, how to do it. So, you know, cut me a check and I'll think about telling you.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
That would be a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah. No, of course I'm just kidding about that. What I mean is that, you know, you put your finger on something really important, that, you know, there are different kinds of challenges. When you're writing a book, there really is no excuse not to explain something well. When you're writing a, because you have plenty of space, when you're writing a book, the challenge is to be interesting and also clear. And, you know, the reader has a short attention span, and you've got to deploy all your tricks to keep them interested. Now, your question, you know, you ask about something else, which is that in a journalistic context, you know, you're writing for a newspaper or a magazine, and space is limited. Yeah, it can be incredibly difficult, and you cannot. The one thing you cannot compromise on is clarity, because being misunderstood is the ultimate sin. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just as bad as getting something wrong. Is to be misunderstood. So it's really difficult. And usually what the journalist winds up having to do is you have to make hard choices, not about cutting explanation, because clarity should never be sacrificed, but cutting entire ideas, you know, cutting entire aspects of the story. You know, sometimes you have to make the really hard decision and just cleave them, you know, and
choosing the depth of the storytelling.
Well, sometimes you do have to sacrifice the narrative. Sometimes you do have to sacrifice story for clarity. But what you wind up having to do in the interest of clarity is sometimes there are just, you know, we call them angles or, you know, aspects mm-hmm. of the story that you just can't get into because you simply don't have the ability to explain them well. And in a book, that happens too. You know, there's a lot of history in my book, but there was a lot more. my editor at Random House, Ryan Doherty, a very fine editor, helped me make some painful decisions about stuff to excise. And it has to be done. You know, and usually, in the case of a book, you do it because you want to sustain the story, you want to sustain the narrative. But what you cannot do under any circumstances is just throw in the terminology without explaining it, because then you've lost clarity, and when you lose clarity, you lose your reader, and you know, you've wasted everyone's time.
So I'd like to pop in quickly just to say, I remember reading Jessica's book and going, at one point going, oh, hey, she's saying phosphorylation, but you had explained it, but, you know, like your explanation wasn't, I didn't need it, right? Uh-huh. Just because of my background. So I'm reading this book really almost like an old friend, enjoying the story, I remember hearing that and stuff like that. But when I realized, I went, oh, she's saying phosphorylation, like everybody knows it. And that's actually a good feeling, I think, for a reader, with knowing you explained it and that you trust them to understand that, to carry that a little further.
Yeah. And then we put the glossary in for when you panic and you're like, I missed that again.
that's a good move.
Yeah, but that was definitely part of the goal was that, you know, you explain it again, come at it from a different angle, and then it's, you know, no, we can just talk about this now, you know.
Right.
That was the hope. Yeah.
Like I trust you trust your reader can do. Yeah. They're smart enough to come and engage with you on this topic. Congratulations, though, because you did nail the vocabulary. It was, you know,
it was hard.
But I, you know, I've had how many years to study and grapple with it. So, Dan, your book represents this, what I like to think of, like, you're not trying to necessarily appeal to scientists. You're trying to sort of put science in and draw people into the science sort of through history and as well as current events. And when I finally left the book, what I felt like was, oh boy, I don't think I can trust ever a single media report that says this causes this. I felt like that you presented that struggle, that doubt of, you know, do we really know something causes something? And does this cluster really mean that when they dumped, you know, whatever into the river, into the beaches or whatever, that's what's causing it? I don't even know what to say, because I left and I was left uncertain about things, but in a really, really good way. I don't even know how to encapsulate that in words. And I'm wondering if that's what you were trying to do, to say, we aren't always right, by the way.
Yeah. I did want to lay out why it is so difficult, because I think that's really interesting. It's like a detective story. And in the end, what you're left with is not a clear verdict, but instead you have to. It's not a criminal case, you know, where things have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. In the world, the reality of the world is it's more like it's more like the standard for a civil lawsuit. You know, what is the preponderance of the evidence?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's really the scientific process. You know, science does not get us to absolute truth. It just gets us ever closer to a reasonably accurate description of how nature works. And the scientific process, through hypothesis and then testing and then rehypothesizing and retesting, you know, eventually inches us closer to an accurate representation of reality. And that is certainly true in the case of the causes of cancer. And so the point that I was really trying to make is the core question is not, can we prove that molecule X causes cancer? The real question is, what is the state of the evidence, and what decision do we make as a country, as a world, and also as an individual? What do we do in the face of uncertainty? You know, what kinds of decisions should we make? Because I think that there's a big misunderstanding on both sides that environmental activists often assume that something is proven when it's not. Mm-hmm. And industry folks often take advantage of this uncertainty and say that because something is uncertain, excuse me for 1 second, and say that because something is uncertain, we therefore ought to do nothing. You know, we ought to just leave a molecule in commerce since we can't prove that it gave person X, you know, bladder cancer or lung cancer. And mm-hmm. and that's just as ridiculous as the first assumption that some chemophobes make. So what we really ought to be doing is weighing the evidence and making smart decisions. And that did not happen in Toms River. And as a result, mm-hmm. I believe the preponderance of the evidence suggests that many children died needlessly. Children died and they did not need uh-huh. to die. And so I hope that the lesson of Toms River is that we need to be smart about weighing the evidence. And when we're not smart, when we just drive ahead and say, well, we can't prove anything, so let's just keep going, sometimes there are tragic results.
When there's a big business interest in the PR firms for the chemical producers or for the cigarette producers or for the anti-anthropogenic climate change people and oil companies and things, whose sole purpose is to create doubt. And then this is pushing the scientists into a corner, who scientists who always deal with contingent truth, and we are taught never ever to say something is absolutely true, are forced in their press briefings to say, oh no, this is absolutely true, even though they don't want to, because otherwise the public will hear all the people saying, see, he said it's only 98% true, which implies that it's maybe 2% not true. Well, good heavens, what tools, and you know, your books contribute to this, but what's the poor, hapless, average person to do with all this bullshit flying around?
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. And and that's why science journalism is so important. And it's why, you know, we're so concerned about what's happening with the economic models, with the business models for science reporting. Because, you know, if not for journalism, you're left with, you know, just sort of a world of spin, you know, where, you know, environmentalist spin versus industry spin, and what are the members of the public supposed to do in that situation? That's a really awful situation, and you know, it's why podcasts like this are so important. We really need to get the word out that independent evidence-based storytelling is vital. It's absolutely vital.
Well, I'm glad you're both out there doing that. So without giving away everything in your books, both of your books have Seba Geigy as a main player.
That's right.
Yes, so Jessica, why don't you tell us about Seba Geigy's role in your book?
Well, so they were, Sipa Ganki, so they're a pharmaceutical company, I mean, no longer a pharmaceutical company. They merged with Sandoz. They were, those two companies were rivals across the Rhine in Basel, Switzerland. And they were one of the first pharmaceutical companies to start a tyrosine kinase inhibitor program. Right, so there was a time, so kinases are a kind of protein, and there are some cancers where a genetic abnormality encodes an abnormal protein, an abnormal kinase in particular. Kinases are enzymes that set processes in motion, so kinase, kinetic, it's in the word. So in this case, this particular kinase, this BCR-ABL kinase, as it's called, is sets in process this unchecked production of white blood cells. So when that became clear that the, you know, how the Philadelphia chromosome mutation was connected to CML, there were people who said, okay, let's, you know, could we try to make a drug that targets this genetic mutation? And one of the, what, there were people outside of the pharmaceutical industry asking that question, and there were people inside the pharmaceutical industry. CML was not the only disease where this were being found, but CML was kind of at the leading edge, and it turned out to also have this most direct connection, that it was this one mutation leading to this one cancer in a very clearly defined way. And so they started a program at SIBA to make a drug to, what, actually it was not, their goal was not to make a drug for CML. At first, they really wanted to target a more common cancer. CML is rare. They wanted to target a more common cancer. And one of the major themes of the book, and what lends it this sort of hopefully kind of thrillerish air as it proceeds, is that not will the drug be made, because we know that the drug is made, but how is it going to get made? Because there are so many pressures within the company acting against it. The most galling of which, of course, is the financial issue. Because CML is a rare disease, and once it was apparent that they had had success creating a kinase inhibitor that targeted CML so effectively, that targeted the mutant kinase driving CML so effectively, and they were hesitating with making it because it's a rare disease, and so how are they going to get their money back? And that was one of the reasons, and there was also the risk in general of trying this entirely new approach. So Sipa Ganki merged with Sandoz to become Novartis, which at the time of that merger, they became the biggest pharmaceutical company in the world. And of course, Novartis is still a giant. And it was at the time of many mergers going on, which is something I talk about, why that was happening, and why merging was the strategy to overcome certain you know, empty pipeline issues in the industry. So that was, so I was writing about the drug development, the pharmaceutical kind of side of Sipa Ganki. And Dan, I guess maybe you can talk about your Sipa Ganki overlay there.
Yeah. There's a bit of a difference. It's interesting, you know, our in this way and in some other ways too, our books really do fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. My book traces, part of my book traces the development of the synthetic chemical industry, which arose out of dyes, out of synthetic dyes. A young guy named William Henry Perkin, experimenting in his parents' attic, created coal tar, out of components of coal tar, created the first aniline dye, and he didn't mean to be do it, of course, like many great moments in science, he was trying to do something else. He was trying to create a synthetic treatment for malaria. But it stained his test tube beautifully in a perfect shade of purple. He called it mauve. And that happened to be the color that was that Princess Eugenie in France and the court in all the ladies of Paris desperately wanted that purple, and it was really tough to make from natural sources. So when Perkins Mauve came out, oh my gosh, everyone wanted it. And Switzerland was a country that at the time and for many years thereafter did not recognize foreign patents. France and England, you know, called it the land of pirates or the land of counterfeiters. So some very sharp folks in Switzerland saw what Perkin had done and basically just appropriated his technology, his process, and created through a series of fascinating business enterprises, built the synthetic chemical industry first in Switzerland and then in Germany. And all of those companies, including Siba Geigy, Siba and then Geigy and Sandoz and BASF, they all arose from the same from this same geographic area and also doing the same things. And what's most fascinating about it to me was that the environmental aspects were quite clear from the very start. You know, starting from the 1860s, the Rhine was horribly polluted, and groundwater next to these factories was in terrible shape, and people were getting very sick or even dying. But the dyes were extremely profitable, and it was the income from dyes that allowed Siba and then Siba Geigy and then eventually Siba Geigy and Sandoz together to expand far beyond dyes into petrochemicals and then eventually into pharmaceuticals. And so Gleevec, you know, has its roots in synthetic dyes in the 1860s. You know, there's just sort of a chain. And you know, the ethics of this are really problematic for Siba Geigy because, you know, there was terrible environmental damage in Basel, and then there was horrible environmental damage in Cincinnati, which after World War I, the Swiss, seeing that the Germans were weak, wanted to get into U.S. Manufacturing, and so they created the Cincinnati Chemical Works, and there became a terrible, absolutely hideous cluster of bladder cancer among workers at the Cincinnati Chemical Works. Mm-hmm. Almost every worker who handled these two particular synthetic dyes got bladder cancer. It was just absolutely horrible. And so what did Siba Geigy do? Well, they moved to Toms River. And so the process repeats itself. And now, of course, there is no Siba Geigy, as Jessica explained. There was a series of mergers, and then the chemical manufacturing was spun off, and what's left of you know, Novartis is now in pharmaceuticals, but you know, BASF is still going strong with synthetic chemical manufacturing and dye manufacturing. And I wrote an op-ed recently for the New York Times in which I explained that, you know, the same process is going on now in China, and we really need to learn from our mistakes, and that isn't necessarily happening. Or if it is happening, it's happening frustratingly slowly.
So another thing your books have in common, because I did want to get back to this blurb on the front, both comes from Siddhartha Mukherjee, who wrote The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. Okay, folks.
Yeah, that's nothing, a pretty good book.
Nothing against your book. I love this book. Okay, so it won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. Fantastic book. If I could have gotten him on in this discussion, I would have done it. But so it doesn't happen so often with nonfiction, but when a book ends and you feel sad, that's how I felt with this book. So his book, of course, looks at that. So I don't know if you both have read it. And, you know, because my goal is to get people reading. I would love them to read your books, but also Siddhartha's.
Yeah.
In that sort of, I know we're coming to the end, and from our previous discussion, I wanted to let anyone listening or watching know that that entire thing about kinase inhibitors and things that Jessica was talking about is all clear after you've read the first 100 pages of her book. I think it's just amazing that I can sit here and listen, but hearing from Joanne her enthusiasm for The Emperor of All Maladies, and we also we've discussed how much we've enjoyed reading both of your books. And there's a general comment that I would make is every time I go to my library and choose a book at random, but also the books that come to me, I'm gratified by the number of really good science books that are being written. There is a lot of really good science writing rather than previous times when I remember a lot of tragically bad science writing. And, you know, that's, you know, a personal thank you to both of you in commendation, but also just something, and maybe this is, you know, because of the people who've been paying you, Dan, but there's there's some bootstrapping or something going on, and the level of expectation and output seems to be going up significantly.
Yeah, I do think the level of expectation is going up, as it should, and the quality in general is going up, and you know, I actually credit the internet for that, in the sense that there's very lively criticism, you know, in the best possible sense of the word. You know, we just had a little dust up this week because The View, you know, the show on ABC, just hired Jenny McCarthy, who is a really ignorant anti-vaxxer, anti-vaccination person, and so that it created a, you know, a dilemma for journalists. Not really a dilemma, actually, but some journalists see it as a dilemma of, you know, how do we cover this and how explicit should we be about the state of the evidence on the non-link between autism and vaccines. And the great thing is, Jeff, that when someone messes up now and does a piece of science journalism that really isn't up to snuff, they hear about it. They hear about it. There are wonderful feedback mechanisms.
I've seen that happening, and you're right. There's, and just in reporting about her, and some people I know try to say, like, well, that's a, you know, that's a personal view. That's something separate. She's going to do it. It's like, well, you know, it's all become part of this, and it's easy for me to say there are so many anti-science people that if one of them comes along, I don't see any harm in pointing out that this may not be the best thing to do because these issues are going to seep in, and it's at least worth knowing now that you shouldn't listen to everything that you hear from everyone.
I think we're doing a lot better. Sorry, Jessica, just one more quick thing. Yeah. I think we're doing a lot better with so-called false balance or phony balance than we used to. And that's great, and, you know, maybe it does have something to do with better training for science journalists. That would be nice. I hope so. But I think the rise of the web is really a big part of it, too. It's hurt science journalism in other ways, economically. But in terms of the quality, it's an improvement.
Yeah.
Sorry, Jessica. Go ahead.
No, I was just kind of going to add that I think that the trick is to balance and off and make sure that the it's clear what's going on without it becoming divisive, right? Without attacking Jenny McCarthy or attacking the person holding the view, not the show, I mean the viewpoint. but, you know, to do it in a way that, because then if it's not, if you can do it in a way that it doesn't cause divisiveness, it's respectful and it's easy to respect then the journalism voice saying, well, actually, you know, there is no link, or there, you know, this is the state of the science for real, or whatever it might be, and not doing it in a way, oh, is that like an alarm in someone's home? Or, are we going off the air?
No.
It's
no.
Like,
sorry, that again. That's my fault again. The volunteer fire department is not far from my house.
I thought you were telling me I had made my point.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I think that's a really good point that Jessica just made, and you know, it's really important for journalism to be evidence based, but it's not necessary for journalism to be snark, and you know that's a downside of the web that that you know there's a kind of a snobism a snobbery that can happen sometimes that oh those ignorant anti-science people well that doesn't accomplish anything except just to alienate people, so tone is really important
so that people can evaluate more objectively what's going on and they'll get the right answer sooner or later.
Wow. So the hour's flown by. I am so excited. I got the chance to speak with both of you, and I just suddenly feel so enlightened in the course of an hour about so much about science journalism that I didn't know before. I'm really impressed with both of you, and I loved both of your books. So, you know, I like a lot of books, but I really, really love both of your books. And like I said, it may be, you know, this is sort of, you know, the biology is my field, and I like the chemistry as presented in Tom Berger. But I learned a lot. I'm so glad you guys came and spent some time talking with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
It was really fun. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks all to both of you. And it's not just because it was biology, Joanne. They're both
I know. Gosh, they're just such great books. Okay. So we'll say goodbye right now, and we'll see you in our next episode.
Bye. Thanks. Thank you. Bye.